us. We are privileged to welcome everyone to our medical ethics class over Zoom. You guys can all come in, at least you can see everyone here. Rabbi Weiner is the Senior Rabbi and Executive Director of the Spiritual Care Department at Cedars-Sinai, Los Angeles, and he is responsible for the chaplaincy team and all aspects of spiritual care throughout the healthcare system. He's authored many books and articles, very involved in medical ethics topics, especially relevant to end-of-life issues that we will be discussing today. I asked Rabbi Weiner to address some of the topics that we've been discussing. There might be time at the end, I know, for some Q&A, but we'll see how much interesting stories you have to share and if there's time for that. So thank you so much for joining us, the floor is yours.
Okay, my pleasure. And remind me where you are again?
So we are in Heichal HaTorah in Bergen County.
Right. Yes. Great to be with you all. Nice to see you. So I thought maybe I'll just share some stories that are relevant for the issues you all have been discussing, and then we can sort of debate the stories, and I'd love to hear your perspectives on them and what halakhic issues you think there are, and depending on how much discussion we have, we'll all share more stories or less stories. I could just keep going, or we can like slow down and like really analyze them. Sounds good?
Yes.
Okay. So I'm going to do different stories than I did last time. I think it was probably different students, but I'll do different stories. Unless you'd if you want me to repeat some of the old stories, I'm happy to do those. But for now, I'll share some new ones. So you hear me clearly?
Yes.
Good. Okay, so here's a story. So pay attention to every single detail of the story, because every single detail that I say is relevant, even though, of course, I'm changing some minor details for anonymity, but every detail will be relevant for, like, the halachic and ethical issues. So there is a man, 86-year-old man. He's 86, and he lives alone. His wife has died, but his children and grandchildren do live in the neighborhood. He spends his days gardening. He loves to garden. It's like his thing in his life. He loves gardening, and he actually makes food from his garden, and then he brings that food over to his children's house every night, a different family member, and they have dinner together, and it's just like that's like the joy of his life, is gardening and walking to his children's homes. Unfortunately, one day, remember he's 86 years old, one day he got an infection. Anyone know how to treat infections? What medication we use? Yes, antibiotics. I heard that. So antibiotics for infections. Of course, there's not just one antibiotic for all infections, right? You have to figure out which is the right antibiotic for each infection. And they actually do that in the hospital. They take cultures. They take, like, blood samples or, you know, cheek swabs, and then they bring it to the lab, and then they, you know, they figure out what's the right antibiotic for that person. So this guy somehow got a very rare, very severe infection. And he... it got so bad that, you know, he was in septic shock. He's in the ICU now. He's on a respirator. He's totally in a coma, not responsive. And they're constantly trying to create the proper antibiotic for him, although each one that they come up with is not effective. It's just not working. At a certain point, they realized that, it's really going poorly because the infection is spreading, and now his extremities are becoming necrotic, like his hands are shriveling, like his fingers are becoming like black and shriveled up and just like dying, and it's getting worse and worse, going further down his hands. Also his feet, his toes, same thing is happening at his feet and toes, kind of just shriveling up and dying, and it's gradually making its way up his feet and down his hands. And the doctors realize this is very severe. What do you think the treatment is for that? What? Yes, amputation. I mean, there's nothing they could do. It's dead. They have to amputate. Not only is that the only way to, you know, treat it, but otherwise it's going to spread further. However, that same day they realized, like, they have to do this, the pathologist came back and they said, you know, we got the right antibiotic. We're confident now this is going to work. This will save his life. Given this antibiotic, it's going to take a few days, but he will survive after he gets this antibiotic. The problem was, it's also getting pretty bad, his hands, his feet, so much so they are going to have to amputate, like, from his elbow down and his knees down, which means he'll wake up from this horrible coma. He will wake up healed because the antibiotics will work, but he will wake up without feet or hands, really much of his leg or much of his arms. And the doctors actually gave the family the option. We could just do nothing and just kind of keep him in this coma and just let him die because it's going to spread. Or we could amputate and save his life and he'll wake up with no hands and no feet. What would you like to do? That's what they asked the family. Before I tell you about any of their reaction, I'm curious to hear your reaction to the story and your initial reactions to what's the right thing to do. Extra credit if you can quote any halachic sources in your answers.
You get halachic sources extra credit. Anybody? Surely you could say it loud.
I would think you have to amputate.
Yeah, you have to amputate. Why?
Get his leg. Hopefully
he doesn't die. Yeah, save his life. Very good. Anyone else? Any other opinions?
Kiva, you have something to add? No.
Endangering his life.
Said it would be endangering his life if you do not amputate. Same idea.
Right. Okay. Would anyone? I agree with you. You make good points. Yeah. Sorry. Was there someone else talking?
Would
someone like, just for the sake of argument, meaning you don't have to agree with what you're going to say, but just for the sake of argument, to try to say something even that you disagree with, why would anyone in their right mind not save his life, not amputate and save his life and just let him die? Could you imagine an argument?
Yeah, so maybe the guy would be willing to take the chance to survive without amputating his arm.
Oh, so you're saying try to save his life, but don't amputate because maybe
The guy would have been okay with taking that risk.
Yeah, okay, the risk. All right, very good. Let's say now the doctor said, though, this is very serious. You have to amputate. It's already spreading. It's already dead. It has no chance of coming back. And it has the potential of spreading throughout his body and killing him. If you want to save his life, you must amputate. There's no other way to save his life.
I'd rather die than live that way.
Right.
You think you'd rather
live? You hear that?
Yeah.
Because you can't do anything. It's like your brain.
Like he doesn't want to live without his limbs. He'd rather be dead.
Oh, yeah. So you're saying maybe someone would rather die than be awake to not having his legs or feet, arms. Is that what you said?
Yeah.
Yeah. And even more so, I mean, obviously the halakhic approach, I mean, I think it's clear we do everything we can to save life. And any kind of life is worth living. And even he would be awake, so it would be great. But you could see, I mean, maybe somewhat of an argument, even though it's a little bit of a difficult argument, but you could see that his whole life was about, you know, gardening and walking to his family. And he's 86 years old, so now if he's going to have to go through rehab and get prosthetics, like, that's a lot to ask of an 86-year-old man. You could see why someone might say that, like, that's a lot to ask. What would you respond if someone said, like, no, that's way too hard? How might you respond, like, no, you should try to save his life, and here's why? What would you say?
Can you just repeat the question? You're saying
let's say, because here's what happened. I'll even tell you what happened next. There was four sons. This man had four sons. Three, and those were only his children. He had four children, all sons. Three of them Orthodox. One of them was no longer observant. However, I won't say who is who, but they started to debate. You can imagine the Frum sons, they were the ones saying, of course, save his life. The one who was not, he was arguing, he was saying he'll become depressed, it'll be too hard for him, he's going to be overwhelmed with the rehab, he never wants to be a burden on us, but he'll have to be such a burden because he won't be able to live in his house anymore because there's lots of steps, and it's so complicated, he won't be able to garden, he won't be able to walk to us, it's too much, he's going to be mad at us for waking him up, let's let him go. So what would the Frum sons respond to that argument and say, no, we should save his life, why?
Akiva, yeah?
Well, you could share so many memories, like, he still, like, has a brain, and he could see things and experience and talk. So, like, all those, let's say he lives for the 120s, but those, whatever, 33 years, whatever it is.
Right.
He could experience things with the family and still share those moments with them. So.
Yeah, he has a lot to live for still, right? He loves his family, can be with his family a lot. And even though his values are about, like, gardening and walking to his family, there's other ways he can accomplish that. And, like, I remember when I was in high school, when I was your age, there was this guy in L.A. who everyone knew in this high school that he was like the star of the football team, and he already received a scholarship to USC to be their starting quarterback, and everyone was like, this guy's going to be in the NFL. He was like a big deal. And the first game of his senior year, he got injured and broke his back, and that was it for football for him. In fact, he was partially paralyzed. And it was just like, okay, his life's over. It's horrible. And I remember at the end of that year, he actually ended up getting a scholarship to college in poetry. And there was an article on the front page of the LA Times about how this guy, who his whole life was football, once he couldn't play football anymore, he basically adjusted his values and became like this master of poetry. So much so they got a scholarship, which like we didn't even know that was even a thing to get a scholarship to college in poetry. But like the point was, he never cared about poetry, but he like got so into it that his values changed. And so like maybe like, yeah, his whole life was football, but it could change if it can't be football anymore. Like that's not the be all end all of life. So what do you think happened? I mean, there's three brothers versus one. So what should happen? How do we navigate that?
Advanced directive.
That would be the best. If there was an advance directive, there's two reasons why an advance directive would save the day. What do you think are the two ways it could have made this no issue anymore?
Can you just review what that is? Because we didn't get to it.
Sure. Oh, okay. Yeah, no problem. So an advance directive is a document that someone could write if someone's healthy, like any of us right now, we could write this. An advance directive, you write in the directive like, who am I? Who's my doctor? Basic things about me. Who's my proxy? Like, who would I want to speak for me if I couldn't speak for myself? Like, I just want you to ask only my wife or only my brother or only this son or that daughter or whatever. And then you describe some of your values in it. We actually just created a new Jewish proxy, and I heard that Rabbi Simcha Willig teaches in your school. So his father, Rabbi Mordechai Willig, just approved it, like wrote, like reviewed it, and gave us his haskam on it. You can look it up if you're interested. It's called the T-Vote from an organization called Amitai that we just created this with Rabbi Willig, and that's an advance directive, a from Jewish advance directive, and that with that you can explain who you want to speak for you, especially if there's a lot of people in your family and you want just a certain person. And you can say what your values are, so you can describe what you would want, so they can know about you and not just like make guesses. So how would that have helped in this situation?
You know exactly who can speak to you, like who that person will go to rely on to speak.
Exactly. There's four sons. We know which one to ask. And maybe he would say something in there like, you know, because we have questions in there about like, you know, how independent do you want to be, and like how much do you value different things, so it could help them. The issue with this, so he didn't have an advance directive. And unfortunately, at the end of life, a lot of families, there's oftentimes family feuds and struggles and fights. One of the things we see, actually, sadly, is that, you know, oftentimes people have to fly in from out of town, right? The children live in different places. First of all, just quick side point. Do you think, let's say a patient's dying, like they're really dying, and but there's something keeping them alive. Like, for example, if can you take someone off a respirator if they'll die right away as a result, halakhically?
No.
So we don't do that. But something we sometimes do, if a patient is dying and they have no chance of recovery and they're suffering, but they're being kept alive by the respirator, is sometimes they might be on a medication called vasopressors. And that keeps their blood pressure strong. It constrains their blood vessels and keeps their blood pressure up, even though their blood pressure might otherwise decline and they would die. But many post-game allow, even though they say you cannot extubate, you can't take the respirator out of their mouth, out of their throat to make them die right away, the vasopressors are in a tube, in an IV line. You can sometimes allow that to run out, and then that will allow them passively to die. You can passively allow death. You can't cause death actively. So let's say it's a case where that's what we're going to do. That's what the postgame said we could do. The patient's suffering. They're dying. There's no chance of recovery. But all these external medications and machines are keeping them alive. So that's what we're going to do. But then there's a family member in Israel or somewhere, you know, like where it's going to take a day or so at least to get there. At least, especially to LA. LA to Israel is, you know, it's a long trip. So do you think it's okay to like, let's say the postgame already said, you could allow the pressors to run out. Let them die. But now that that's happening, could you keep them alive for another day to wait for the family to arrive? think that's okay? Or why? Yes. Why yes? Why no?
Say it loudly. Why you think yes?
Why not?
Yeah,
because you're saying they're suffering.
Yeah, if they're suffering, though there's things we could do for it. Yeah, so the answer is yes. It's just it is awkward orchestrating someone's death based on that, but for sure, because we hope that they appreciate, even though they can't talk and interact, we do believe that people who are dying recognize when someone's near them. That's why we say, like, someone shouldn't leave the bedside of a dying patient, because it comforts them that they're close by. Actually, speaking of Rabbi Willig, we had a crazy Shaila here during COVID that I asked him, which was that, you remember, like, when Israel closed down sometimes, when they weren't taking any flights in or out, and you couldn't get to Israel. And obviously, as we know, a lot of people in our community asked to be buried in Israel. So we had the following case. We had a patient whose family, who was dying, and the family knew that he wanted to be buried in Israel. And that was very important. In fact, his wife was already buried in Israel. He had a plot right next to her. And what some people were doing at that time was just burying locally and then exhuming. Like, they'll say, okay, we'll just bury you in LA. And then in 6 months or whatever, we'll exhume the body and fly to Israel. But the family was saying, well, wait a second, why don't we just do this? Why don't we just do everything we can to keep him alive? Like, even intubate someone who wasn't already on a respirator and keep their body going until Israel opens up again. Then when Israel opens up, then we'll let them die, and then we can just go straight to Israel and not have to bury them in LA and then move them in 6 months to Israel. What do you think? What's the right thing to do then?
That's disgracing, the dead body, kind of.
Yeah. Almost. Yeah, I agree. First of all, there's halanos hames, it's prevent, not burying. And then nivel hames, disgracing the body. Yeah. So, and Rabbi Willig, when I asked him, he said, for sure, don't do that. Just bury them in LA. If you have to reinter them, you'll reinter them like that. Don't do that. So anyways.
We have one question.
Yeah.
Do you want to?
Yeah.
Well, why, if you could keep him alive for 6 more months in that case, why would you keep him alive for 6 more months in general?
Well, because the case is it's a patient who's in the dying process and there's pain associated with that and they're dying. And you almost always could keep someone alive longer with artificial means and just kind of prolong, make their body work by putting them on more and more machines. So you put them on a respirator for their lungs. You put them on dialysis for their kidneys. You give them artificial feeding. Like, you give them all this stuff. And at a certain point, their body is like somewhat alive, but like as a human being, like, they're not alive. Their body's decaying. Like, it's really, it's kind of cruel in some ways. If they could recover and they could overcome their illness, then it's a great mitzvah. But it's another thing when they're suffering and dying and in horrible pain. And So what happens a lot is that, let's say a family member is flying in. Something we often find is that the family member who flies in, let's say the whole family is together, and they all live there, wherever you are. But then there's that one family member who lives far away and they're flying in. And then the family has to make a decision together. Oftentimes we find that the family member, not always, but oftentimes the family member who lives far away is more aggressive in terms of trying to prolong life. Do everything you can. And whereas the other family members who've been by their side the whole time oftentimes are more like, you know what, they've suffered enough. Maybe it's okay to let them go. Anyone want to guess why that might be, that the one living far away is sometimes more aggressive in trying to keep them alive?
They want to get a chance to say goodbye to them.
Yeah, they want to have a chance to see them. Sometimes they feel guilt because they weren't the ones taking care of them and being with them, whereas the ones who are with them the whole time saw how much they suffered and how much they've tried already, and they want to sometimes not obviously put them out of their misery. We wouldn't say it that way, but sometimes they're ready to let them go, and that happens. But unfortunately, there's huge family feuds, and the best way to avoid those family feuds is, in fact, if there's an advance directive. In this case, what happened was, I told you there's three sons who were saying, they're from guys. They're all saying, do whatever you can to keep him alive. It's okay. Amputate. It's worth it. The one son who was saying not to was the oldest. And the way the law works is that since no one was appointed and he didn't have a wife anymore, so they go by your children in order of age. And he was the oldest of the four. So he had the say by California law. And he said to the doctors, you know what, just let him go. The other brothers were horrified by that. They couldn't believe that he would say that. In fact, they started calling rabbis, and everyone was calling me and other rabbis, saying you've got to convince them, do everything you can to convince them. And in fact, we tried. We tried to convince him. We talked to him about it. And his argument was, I'm the oldest, and therefore I know him the best because I've known him the longest, even though they were all like in their 40s and 50s. They've known him plenty of time. But they felt like, but he said, I'm the oldest. First of all, I know him the best. Second of all, when he wakes up and sees that we did this to him, that you know, we amputated his legs and arms, he's going to blame me. He's going to say to me, you're the oldest son, you're responsible, and now I'm upset at you. And so he felt that he had the right to make this decision. And even all the pressure we put on him to save his father's life, he said no. And he told the doctors, this is my say, don't amputate, and don't even give him the antibiotics, just let him go. And in fact, 5 days later, the patient died. And since then, the family has not spoken to that son. Yes, wow. Comment, question.
How much older was he than the rest of the brothers?
Like 3 years.
What? How does he have any argument?
I mean, he claims that he knows him better and he's been around longer, but that is the law, like that you go in order when there's a disagreement.
Right.
And so that's what he did. And the other brothers were furious.
Can I ask a question? Is there any push in the Orthodox community for everyone to get some kind of props or advanced directive? Because young people, you know, you kind of hope that you're okay and you don't think to do it. And unfortunately, there are situations, but most younger individuals don't have anything written up.
Yeah, there has been a push. In fact, you're in Bergenfield. I remember hearing Rabbi Neuberger talk about once, you know, at age 50, people should have this. And I've heard people talk about even getting just when you're 16, when you get your driver's license. I know Rabbi Zone in Queens has this thing, you know, that he, in Parshas Vayechi every year, he has to make this whole push. We asked all the rabbis around the country to speak about it, that everyone should have an advance directive and think about these things. And he also made an advance directive. And now he uses ours that we created with Amitai that I mentioned before. There has been a push. I mean, it's scary for people. People don't want to talk about it because, first of all, everyone thinks they'll live forever. And people are worried about Ayin Hara and things like that. But the reality is that it's not an Ayin Hara. In fact, they say that if a person purchases their burial plot when they're alive and well, it's a segula for richas yamim, segula that they'll live long. And we say the same thing is for an advanced directive. You should, you know, it's like the Chavetz Chaim actually says in the Pirkei Avos on the Mishnah, im ein ani li mi li. You know, who else is going to speak for me if I don't speak for myself? So he talked about having a tzava, tzava mechaim, that's how they said it in Hebrew. It was the same, similar idea. It's important.
Question?
If you don't have a proxy, does it go to your parents?
Yeah, for a child, it'll go to your parents. I mean, for a minor. The one case, though, just by the way, one case where it won't is on your driver's license. I think in New Jersey, it's the same, right? Age 16 is driver's license. You can drive?
17, they get their license. They get permits at 16.
Okay, so close. So you know that when you get your driver's license, you have the option to become an organ donor. And they put that on the license. Now, the way that works is that if you have that on your license, and we do believe organ donation is a big mitzvah in Judaism, but it is complicated. Posthumous organ donation after someone dies is not always a mitzvah, right? Sometimes it's not allowed, sometimes it is. It's a big debate. But if a person has it on their license, they don't even ask the parents. And I've had a few cases where 16-year-olds, in California it's 16, but it's the same story, where we've had 16-year-olds who unfortunately, sadly, got into accidents and died. They were brain dead. And the hospital said, okay, we're taking the organs, you know, let's arrange for the organ retrieval surgery. But since they're brain dead, they're on a respirator. So, like, they can say, we can do that tomorrow or next week. There's time. And they'll often say, like, the parents can come and say goodbye. And the parents will come in and say, like, what do you mean, say goodbye? We don't agree to it. Like, you didn't even ask our opinion or our permission. And the doctors will say, it's not up to you. If it's on the driver's license, it's their decision. And it's no one else's decision, and you don't get a say. Which can, as you can imagine, can lead to very contentious situations. I've had cases where that brought a lot of comfort to the family afterwards, where they were like, they fought it, but then they lost. And so in the end, they were very comforted. And I've had cases where the families fought like crazy, and sometimes they were able actually to convince the hospital not to do it because they fought so much and were able to even get like media attention and things like that. I'll give you one. I think we only have 12 more minutes, right?
Yes.
So let me give you one more case just so we can use our time well. Because we just had this case and I thought it was fascinating and it's very relevant because I think I was told you talked about brain death, right?
Yes.
Yes.
So it's a brain death and also withholding withdrawing case. So here's the case, and I'm really curious to hear your reactions to this. We had a patient who was young woman, relatively young, young in my opinion. She was in her 40s, so in my world that's young, because I'm in my 40s. So she got an illness, kind of very fluke thing. It was based on a kind of type of a flu, and it developed in a way that actually caused her brain to become infected, and she became brain dead. And she wasn't quite brain dead yet at this point, but she was in her neuro ICU. They realized she's not recovering. It's not going well. So they asked for a family meeting. This was a very, very frum family. And we were having a meeting to discuss what's going to happen. And in our neuro ICU, I mean, our hospital is a very Jewish hospital. I mean, it's not only Jews, but we have a lot of frum people. And our hospital is very used to dealing with religious Jews. And they knew, just looking at this family, that they were a Haredi family and that they were not going to accept brain death because that's usually what happens, and that they were going to need to be accommodated. And we have in our hospital a religious accommodation where we will make sure that people are accommodated if they don't accept death by neurological criteria. So as we're talking about it, the husband of the patient was like, wait a second, why are you assuming that we don't accept brain death? And I even said to them, like, I know who your rabbi is, and I know that you spoke to him, and I know that he doesn't accept brain death. And they're like, yeah, that's true. We spoke to him and he told us, don't accept brain death. But here's the thing. The husband of the patient and two of the children are doctors and nurses. They're a very medical family. And they were like, you know, we do accept brain death, like medically. But we know our rabbi doesn't. So I said to them, I was like, well, I know there is one posik in your community that does accept brain death. Should we call him? And they're like, no, wait, that's not right. Like, do you think it's right to just call another rabbi because the rabbi you called, who's your rabbi, you don't like his answer? Is that the right thing? So just call someone else? What do you think?
Yeah, man, yeah.
No, I don't think so. I mean, because in most cases of Halacha, you can't just, like, pick and choose which rabbi to follow. I don't think that's how
right.
You're supposed to do
it. Right. In fact, in our hospital, our morgue is in our lower level, like our basement. And the only thing that's down there is there's a pharmacy. And one day I got a call from someone that he's a pharmacist, a frum guy. He got a job offer in the pharmacy in our basement, which is right down the hall from the morgue. So he asked me if he could take the job. And I felt bad because, you know, this is our parnassa. So I didn't want to just say no, even though I didn't see any heter. But I realized I needed to call a posik. So I said, you know, let me call you back. So I called a major posik here in L.A., asked him the shayla, and he goes, did so-and-so just call you? I was like, yeah, how'd you know? He goes, because he just called me and I told him no. So he's calling you now because he's heter shopping. So I called him back and I was like, yeah, my answer is the same answer as the other rabbi. He's like, oh, you caught me. So it's not right to just heter shop. So the family was like, no, we can't call another rabbi. It just doesn't feel right. So we were talking and the family had an idea. And I'm going to tell you their idea and you tell me if you think this is mutter. What do you think about this? The family knows medicine. So the doctors were like, okay, well, the plan was, before you interrupted, the plan was, we'll do all the brain death testing. If he's declared brain dead, then we'll just do nothing. We're not going to remove anything. We'll just allow everything to be the same. And over time, probably his heart will stop, but we're not going to rush it. We're not going to make him die faster. But the family knew, well, one of those tests is an apnea test. Did you all learn about apnea tests?
We didn't discuss apnea tests yet.
You did not?
No.
Okay, so an apnea test, you'll learn about it more in depth, but just briefly, very, very briefly, they actually turn off the respirator in an apnea test. They first, you know, hyperoxygenate the patient. They take a blood sample to see how much carbon dioxide is in the blood. Then they don't give them the respirator for a little while, for about 6 minutes, and they check the blood again to see how much their carbon dioxide went up. If it went up to a certain level, they realize that your brain stem of any person, if it's functioning, it'll try to breathe if the carbon dioxide gets so high. If the person doesn't try to breathe, that's proof that they're brain dead. So the family said, what if we try this? What if when you do the apnea test, he's not going to be on the respirator then anyways. Our rabbi told us, when we asked him, he said, I don't accept brain death, but if they have to stop, you know, anything, you don't have to restart it. And that what he was saying was based on something in the 80s, a long time ago, when someone was on a respirator, it was connected to a tank. and the tank would sometimes run out, and you have to refill the tank. So Rav Moshe said, if the tank runs out, and the person's dying, and they're brain dead, you don't have to refill the tank. You give them a new tank, because it's shev al tase, it's passive. But now we don't really have that psak anymore, because the respirator's plugged into the wall, and it gets continuous oxygen. There's no stoppage. But the family said, wait a second, our rabbi told us, if anything stopped, you don't have to restart. He doesn't know necessarily about apnea tests, but we do. So doctor, now they said to the doctor, when you do the apnea test, if the results come in right away and you can see right away that the CO2 in the blood, if he's not breathing, she's not breathing, then then that she's brain dead, and just don't turn the respirator back on, and we'll be fine with that. And in that way, it'll allow natural death. What do you all think about that solution? How does it sound to you?
It's very interesting.
It's
not end to life.
Sorry?
He said...
You're not doing more than trying to trick, because then you know it's going to end to life through that. It's basically killing at that point.
You're saying it sounds problematic because you know it's going to end their life.
Yeah, they're doing it intentionally to make the life, to exacerbate death.
Right, except the reason the doctor's doing it is because they want to declare brain, they want to know this, they want to diagnose the patient. So it's a medical intervention that's being done for medical reasons. And their argument was, if he's brain dead to us, he's dead. To our rabbi, he's not. But our rabbi said, we don't have to restart anything, and therefore we can just leave it v'shei v'altase. So anyways, they felt confident they wanted to do that. They asked me what I thought about it, not as a psak, because like I said, first of all, I'm not a posek. Second of all, they don't want to shop around to a posek. But they just said, like, how does that sound to you? And I remembered, now I don't know if he wants to publicize this psak, but I remember, because my job is to call poskim and ask them shilas. And I once asked for Shmuel Kamenetsky, Shlita in Philly, you know, a shila, about a brain of the shila, and he suggested this approach. So I said to them, well, I do remember one posek once suggesting something like that. I'm not saying that it applies to this case. If we really want to know, we should call him and ask. Or we should call your rabbi and ask. And they were like, no, we don't want to call rabbis right now. This is what we want to do. Doctor, can you do it? So the truth is, normally we have to send the labs down to our lab, and it takes half an hour to get the results. But we were able to find, we had to go on a search. We found this machine we could do the test in the room and get the results. And they did it. They did that apnea test. During the apnea test, it showed conclusively brain death within those 6 minutes. And then they told the doctor, do not re-intubate, do not turn the respirator back on. And at that moment, right then when this test showed brain death, the staff declared death. But I was in the room actually for it, watching it. And then I texted the family, okay, we're coming out. We went out. We said, you can come back in the room now. And to us, we said, let's now say Tehillim. We watched the monitor. And when his heart stopped, that's when we said, like, Kriya Shema and all that stuff, as if, like, that was when he died, based on what their rabbi said. I actually ended up calling that other rabbi, who I told them, I don't want to say names right now, because I don't know if these two rabbis I'm mentioning right now would want it to be publicized, but I called the other rabbi in their community, who accepts brain death, and I said, what would you have said if we would have called you? Would that have been appropriate? Or would you have said, don't get me involved, I don't want to go against the other rabbi? And he actually said, he said, I'm more of an expert than that other rabbi, and therefore I would have been okay with you calling me, and I would have been okay with going against him, because I know this halacha better than he does. Which, okay, that was quite a thing to say, and that's why I'm not saying his name. But what do you think? What do you think about that story?
I mean, there's definitely circumstances where there are more experienced rabbanim in certain areas.
Right, like kosher or whatever.
You know, your particular rav might not be as knowledgeable in, like, issues of withdrawing, withholding.
Yeah.
And that's shopping around. It's just trying to speak to a rav who's a little bit more experienced.
Yeah, for sure.
In those topics. Right, he said, Yoni said that you would think that the rav would say, you should refer to a different rav. I'm not as experienced in this area.
Except in that case, the first rav was someone who did know what he was talking about. It's just that the other rabbi felt that he knows better. Because we did have a case. I'll conclude with one last story that just kind of drives home the importance of the class you're taking right now and the importance of knowing these things. I remember we once had a case of a patient who was also very sick and dying in our ICU, or likely dying in our ICU. And we had some family meetings, and the family said, you know, we asked our rabbi, we brought up DNR, you know, do not resuscitate. And most postgames say, you know, you can't do a DNR in general, but if a patient is dying and suffering and has no chance of recovery and they don't want to endure that suffering, you can allow natural death. You can have a DNR. So we brought it up in this meeting, and the family said, oh, no, no. Before the meeting, we asked, the doctor mentioned it to us, and we asked our rabbi. Our rabbi said Judaism never allows DNR, so no, we're against it, no DNR. A week went by, the patient wasn't doing so well. We had another meeting, the family said, no way, no DNR. Do not even bring up DNR, we are against DNR. Then I get a call a few days later from the son of the patient, the one who's been saying all along, no DNR. And he calls me and he says, Rabbi, how do we make my father, you know, the patient, no code? Now, no code in medical language means DNR. It means you do not code the patient. You do not resuscitate them. It's just another way of saying DNR. I was like, I thought you were against DNR. He says, oh, yeah, 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 DNR. No, 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 no DNR. We don't want DNR. We just want no code. It doesn't make sense. It's a contradiction in terms. So I said to him, let me come upstairs and talk to you. So I went up to the room. And in our ICU, like most ICUs actually, the rooms all have like glass doors. And he says to me, the patient in the room next to us, all of a sudden they yelled out, they started beeping and they started calling out, code blue, code blue. And we saw like 20 doctors and nurses rush into the room. They were pounding on his chest. They put something in his mouth, in his nose. They started putting in IV lines and started putting in drugs. And we saw like blood splattering. It was going on for like 45 minutes. And then they walked out and they said the patient died. And I asked the nurse, what was that? She said, that was a code. So we said, we do not want that. So that's what we're saying. I was like, well, you know, that's DNR, what you're saying now, if you don't want that. So I said, could you call a rabbi? I called the rabbi, told him that whole story. And the rabbi said to me, oh, that's what DNR means? He goes, honestly, I didn't understand. I didn't know what DNR stands for. So I told him no. But yeah, that's what DNR means. And then yes, I was so shocked when he said, I was like, how are you posking a Shaila when you don't even know what the word means? You don't even know what DNR stands for. It's so irresponsible. So that's why it's important to know this stuff. I know we're out of time, but lots to talk about. But it's so important. Take this class seriously. You have a great teacher, and I'm sure you can learn a lot from her. And it's important stuff because this happens to everybody. And it's you know, at some point in their lives or their family's lives, it's important to be knowledgeable about this stuff. And the Torah has so much to say about it.
It impacts many different professions. So
yes. Yes, for sure.
Thank you so much. We know you have a very busy schedule, so thank you for taking
the
time.
No, my pleasure. It's important.
We really, really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
For doing yeah, my awesome. Pleasure.
Have a good day.
Thanks. You too. Bye.